In this fourth lecture, HBA-HCA, we are taking up the level four of the six levels of processing, issue five. This material has been developed in order to make PCs process faster and come upscale higher and be a little more able about what they're doing. It's quite interesting that there are some people around who can stand a little bit greater ability. If we note the amount of confusion in existence, we are liable to believe that a tolerance for it or an ability to handle it is sometimes desirable. I was mixed up in a confusion one time. They call it World War II. I don't know, you might have been around too. It was all right if you remembered when to duck. Some of the chaps I knew didn't duck. But no real criticism of it, you understand. It was merely slightly confusing. Particularly confusing this long away from it, because here we are feeding most of the peoples that we won from. I've been trying to find out what we won from them. And evidently we won from them the right to take care of them. But the amount of confusion in existence might possibly indicate a necessity for some greater ability on the part of people in order to handle this thing called confusion. One of the basics of confusion is under the heading, "It must not happen again." Now, by the time an individual has said, "It mustn't happen again," to nearly everything that can happen, everything, of course, that happened would be something that mustn't happen again. And in view of the fact he said it mustn't happen again, and it happens again, in view of that fact, why, he feels he's been overwhelmed. His power of choice has been overset. He said it mustn't happen again, and now his power of choice has been overset and overthrown, and here it is happening again. And so he gets confused. His level of expectancy has been overridden. He said, "It mustn't happen. I mustn't be eaten again. I mustn't be shot at by another blonde. I mustn't be operated on again. I mustn't volunteer again," as so many people thoughtlessly did in World War II. What do you know? He finds himself being eaten, one facsimile at a time. He finds himself marrying another blonde. And they have World War 86, if the world lasts that long. That's rather odd supposition. It'd be some other world. World War 2.5. I think the next war will last about half a war's worth. 20 minutes, anyway. Boom. Well, that was the end of that war. He finds himself volunteering, anyway, when the world situation becomes, as they laughingly say, tense. World situation will be past tense, won't it? And so he finds himself doing all these things again, and he said, "Well, this mustn't happen. Our power of choice is overthrown. And if my power of choice is overthrown, I am dead, and therefore it mustn't happen, and it mustn't happen again, and it mustn't happen again," and so on. A very funny part about it is two things right here. Confusion of any kind is tolerable. You can tolerate any confusion. What's confusion? It's just a bunch of unexpectednesses on the part of particles. They're just unexpectedly going in various unexpected directions, and there's a bunch of unexpected incidents occurring, and therefore he didn't expect it, so therefore he says, "I'm confused." Well, as we've said before, one horse walking down the street of a small town could be too many particles for one man. And therefore, he would be confused. He would see a horse walking down the street, and he'd say, I'm confused. Another fellow's tolerance of confusion is about, Piccadilly Circus at the rush hour. And he'd say, how calm, how tame, you know. He can tolerate that, that's nothing. Well, these two chaps have different expectancies. And both of them have different ideas about what must or mustn't happen again. And the fellow who says it mustn't happen again has narrowed everything down to it mustn't happen again, has got one horse walking down one quiet street, and he's saying, that's confusing. Why is he saying it's confusing? Because he said that mustn't happen again, too, you see. And the fellow who looks at Piccadilly Circus and sees it going all around in circles and so forth says, my, everything is sure dull around here. Why, he expected that traffic to go on running. He would probably be startled, however, at an unexpected turn of the traffic. If all the cars turned into dragons or something like that, he would probably be confused. Main difficulty here is the correlation between prevention and fact. Individuals preventing it, and the fact is occurring anyhow. The state in which most people live. They're busily preventing living, and they're going on living. And this is a thing to them which is very upsetting. But their basic postulate, it mustn't happen again, means no duplication must occur. And if we study the communication formula that's carried in The Creation of Human Ability and expanded in Dianetics 1955, we discover very easily that a great many things must happen again. In fact, every time you talk to somebody, it must happen again. You cannot possibly talk to anybody unless you are willing to duplicate. And what is the willingness to duplicate except willingness to have something happen again? Make the same as. In other words, we have terminal one, we must be willing to have terminal two. If we have the idea that nothing must happen again, we have terminal one, and we never get terminal two. Do you get the idea? So we get a single terminal, we get the only one complex, we get all sorts of things occurring on this postulate that it mustn't happen again. Mustn't happen again means no duplication. No duplication means no communication. If an individual can't communicate, he can't be paid. Communication is the pay of life. If you can't communicate, you can't be paid. That's all there is to it. If you can't talk, money's going to be meaningless to you, too. If you cannot communicate to your fellow man, you are not going to be paid in the coin. Of course, money is kind of a communication, too, but it's a solid particle communication. Communication with thought and meaningness behind it, and communication with only mess behind it, they don't quite compare as communications. A communication with only mess behind it would hardly be called a communication at all, because the formula of communication contains, as well as duplication, live form. If you've ever gone to a pawn shop and tried to get some money, you know there's no live forms around this. The fact of the case is that duplication, intention, attention, cause, distance, effect, terminals, live forms, you know, that is terminals. All these things are necessary to this. You should know this quite well. You should know the formula of communication quite well. You should understand when we say two-way communication, we mean a very, very precise thing. We mean Joe says something to Bill, and Bill becomes Bill Prime and acknowledges, and Joe becomes Joe Prime and receives the acknowledgement. And that's not a full communication yet. Bill has to acknowledge and Joe has to receive it, and then Joe Prime says that he got it and acknowledges it, you know, and then Bill Prime has to see that Joe Prime did acknowledge it. Now, if we can't have a communication, then we get some kind of a conversation that goes on like this. A fellow says, go to lunch. And the other fellow says, I've broken it. This doesn't make sense. Understanding to a very marked degree depends upon the ability to duplicate not only what's said, but the other terminal to some degree. You can't talk to a beggar if you don't like being beggars. If you don't like being a beggar, if you can't be a beggar to some extent, don't expect to talk to beggars. If you can't be a lord to some extent, don't talk to a lord because you won't be able to talk to him, you see. Willingness to be, to do, to have is in itself willingness to live. But you have to be able to duplicate that which you see and that to which you speak, or you're not in communication with it at all. Now, it's quite remarkable the slightness of duplication necessary to carry on a conversation. But men, when they become aberrated, cease to duplicate. And one of the reasons they cease to duplicate is because they do not want to be the same as. They're afraid of being the same as. They become the same as, why, it might happen again. Let us take an individual who has played all the roles there are, and he's died because of each one. Let's take him in that state of mind. He's been everything there is to be, and he has come to grief and death because he has been all these things. And now we ask him the question, what are you willing to be? And he'll say nothing. He's not willing to be a thing. He's been all these things, and he found they were all bad, so he doesn't dare do it again, or in other words, duplicate. So we have a synonym here. We say do it again, duplicate, same thing. All right. Now, we take up this problem of duplication, and we discover that obsessions or fixations of one kind or another inhibit it or prevent it. Here's this individual who cannot stand the confusion. He can't stand the confusion of one horse walking down one street. We put him in the middle of Piccadilly Circus, and yipes. Man would practically go into a psychotic break. See that? There's just too many motions going in too many directions. He is fixedly incapable of duplicating more than one motion. Now get the idea of duplicating a motion. Instead of duplicating a thing or being a thing, get the idea of duplicating emotion. In order to see emotion, you have to be able to be it slightly. See that? All right. There is this system of tolerance. There are these tolerances which an individual has to have. The first and foremost tolerance is a tolerance of knowingness. That's an interesting thing. See? We seldom think of having to be tolerant of somebody who knows. But nevertheless, this is true. Sages, since time immemorial, have gotten cuffed around simply because a lot of chaps couldn't stand the idea of somebody else knowing. We take some fellow who has a deep and oppressive secret which is weighing upon his conscience, and he runs into somebody who knows an awful lot, and he feels very uneasy in their presence, because he feels that he might know his secret, too. Matter of fact, secret is seldom worth knowing. But that is tolerance of knowingness. All right, we see less of that in these enlightened times, but on frontiers and in dark ages and so forth, we have somebody turn up with some knowingness, and the first thing you know, why, some church or another, not to mention any names because I never mention the Roman Catholic Church, burns him at the stake or something. He is therefore penalized for knowing, you know. Galileo finds out that planetary systems thus and so, and they finally practically put him in prison, you know. They do things like this, not just the church, but almost anybody. And you look for this tolerance of knowingness, and you find out that you'd better take it into account for this reason. Somebody who's looked at you and said you were stupid was hoping that you would get more stupid because he was tolerant of your stupidity, maybe a little bit, but he wasn't tolerant of you knowing anything. Get the idea? The student who comes into the physics or literature classroom and knows a bit more about it than the professor is not well tolerated. The professor has to be a pretty big man before he tolerates that sort of thing. All right. We look this over, and we discover there's a second tolerance, and that is one with which you probably have a little greater acquaintance. It's merely peculiar that our particular group has a greater intolerance of this than other groups, but we kind of specialize in this one, and that's tolerance of stupidity. An individual must be able to tolerate stupidity, and we certainly don't tolerate it very well. Have you ever seen an auditor sit there waiting for a preclear to get a cognition? Preclear is supposed to find out something about himself. The auditor's already known it for 5 days. And the auditor's sitting there waiting for this character, Cognite, you know. Sometimes if the auditor himself is not well processed and pretty much at ease, why, he can just feel his nerves coming to pieces under this terrible strain. It isn't the strain of waiting. It isn't the strain of boredom. It is simply the strain of stupidity. He is intolerant of this PC's not knowing us. After an auditor's run a great deal of Waterloo Station, he becomes quite tolerant of this, by the way. So the fellow was stupid. Well, that's just one more person he could tell something to. A stupid person is an asset. Of course, people who want confusions, like the head of the Gremlin. That's a political party or something, isn't it? Such a person thrives on stupidity. He counts on it. He couldn't control in any direction unless he had a lot of stupidity, you see. If anybody came along and said, "We're going to smarten up your boys," he would think his territory had been invaded. He would be quite convinced that somebody meant him no good at all, because the terrain was going to get smartened up. Matter of fact, a good government can only exist in the presence of a smart people. You cannot take a stupid people and have a good country. All right. This chap would rather favor stupidity, but not in our particular group. We look at this differently. We have different facts before us. We understand quite clearly that the assets of a nation, for instance, consist of its ability as a people, its individual ability to perform jobs, to think of ideas, to put them into execution and carry on a game, and that the wealth of a nation depends upon the wisdom of its own people, their smartness and cleverness, the natural resources, their abundance, and the technologies which it has, which it can put into effect. And these are riches, not pounds or pence. We know that, because a bunch of smart guys get together, they can certainly make anything serve as pounds or pence. You see, that's secondary. But we understand this, and so we are liable to be just a little bit more intolerant of not knowing this. And even though we run an awful lot of Waterloo Station, I dare say we will be still fairly intolerant of not knowing this on a wide level. Now, we take duplication. An individual who is unwilling to know something, you see, he's unwilling to know something, is stupid. If an individual is therefore unwilling to duplicate, he is unwilling to know, because knowingness in essence, or anything in essence, is a bit of knowingness, you see. And so if the fellow is unwilling to know Joe, he's unwilling to duplicate Joe, his knowingness is cut down just to that degree, isn't it? To the degree that he won't know Joe. Well, if an individual won't know stupidity, he cannot himself be smart. We can't be frozen on a high IQ. A high IQ is high only because it's flexible. And a very high IQ is able to tolerate an awful lot of stupidity around. Otherwise, he fights the stupidity and himself fixes on being stupid. See that? So you have to be perfectly willing to duplicate stupidity. You just have to be able to look at something and say, "Huh, I don't know what it is." You know very well what it is, and you have to be able to say, "Well, I don't know what it is." Actually, a thetan knows all there is to know anyhow. All right, we take this duplication, and we get the whole subject of intolerance lying before us there. Now, an individual who can't stand confusion is simply an individual who can't duplicate random motions. He doesn't dare duplicate random motions. He feels he'd spin. In other words, he's unable to duplicate a random motion. But this is very spectacular. We ourselves can recognize this very clearly, that we do not like too many confusions or too many confusing motions in our vicinity. We don't like this too much. As a matter of fact, nobody does, but it's observable to us. We can tell that. We can see that. More insidiously, much more insidiously, we do not like motionless motions. We don't notice that so much. We know that we don't like somebody flying around the room and crawling the walls, and screaming and falling in dead faints and all this sort of thing, we say, oh, for heaven's sakes. But somebody just sitting still on and on and on in complete silence is actually harder to tolerate. Now, this person is doing a repetitive motion. They are apparently sitting still, but they're doing a repetitive motion. Do we see that? They are there at each consecutive second, aren't they? So they must be duplicating just one thing, sitting still, you see. Both of these conditions of too much motion, too little motion, have a tendency to resolve and under the impact of what we used to call opening procedure by duplication. Not sure why it ever got called opening procedure by duplication, because nobody would certainly ever open a case this way. But it certainly does open the doors to beingness. It opens the doors to many things which are desirable, such as perception. The whole subject of perception is the ability to receive and to give out an impression. And if we can give an impression or receive an impression, we can then perceive. A thetan can only see those things he is to some degree willing to be. He is only willing to be those things which he to some degree can know or see. So we take this duplication, and we look it over, and we find out that it is duplicating a motion. It's not duplicating a stillness. The oddity is that opening procedure with duplication would not work if the individual simply sat still. Every once in a while we hear this offered as a technique, and it is offered off the whole track. It's way back when. It is found in mysticism and so forth here on modern earth, but it does not have any great usefulness, simply sitting still. You could probably sit still without thinking and achieve some slight benefit, but you'd better not think anything while you're sitting still. You know, the whole two back corners of the room and don't think is quite a different thing than merely sitting still. It at least has some space a fellow can retire into. So the repetitive motion of this duplicative process is not a sitting still motion, but an individual doing a repetitive motion has the sensation of doing nothing. You ever notice that? A fellow who stands at the drill press and a new piece of iron comes in and he stamps on the press, and another piece of iron comes in, he stamps on the press, another piece of iron stamps on the press. After a while, he'll have the idea he's been doing nothing all day. All time sort of merges into the horrible sameness of this action. Well, this would be very well, and we would say this continued, unless the individual himself were there by some other choice than his own, we would have this interesting thing. We'd have the individual being impressed or forced into this repetitive motion, and then he would appear to be motionless or frozen to himself, you see. Therefore, the preclear, forced into opening procedure by duplication, forced into it, you see, wouldn't achieve any benefit from it at all. He'd have to be persuaded into it. He'd have to have some idea of why he was doing it. And you just saying, well, we just have a drill here. It's to raise one's tolerance of motionlessness and confusion or something like that. And we're going to do this drill, and it's all right with you. And we'd have to get his consent before we ran this. Otherwise, we'd be inviting chaos. Now, opening procedure by duplication, therefore, runs on a high power of choice best. An individual who really wants to run it gets the most out of it, of course. But nevertheless, the body, being put through a repetitive drill, can achieve some benefit, even though the individual's fighting back at it. It's not bad for him to that degree, you see. But this process will blow more preclears out of session than any other that we have. You can blow a preclear out of session with opening procedure by duplication. He just gets just so far, and that's enough of that nonsense, and he quits. And so you have to run it with lots of two-way communication. And that's the only thing really new beyond the not knowingness factor of our modern duplication process. The individual then has to be able to duplicate. This process teaches him some way to duplicate. It also teaches him how to not know, and that fits well into duplication, and so raises his tolerance of stupidity. In other words, we raise the individual's tolerance by raising his power of choice. We raise his power of choice by showing him that he can go through these motions without dying in his tracks, although he will believe at times that death or even a more horrible fate is imminent. He nevertheless begins to understand that he could tolerate a repetitive action. His communication level improve and other things will happen. Now, the four tolerances, let me list them all, are tolerance of knowingness, tolerance of not knowingness, tolerance of too much motion, tolerance of too little motion. See? Too little motion we call minus randomity, because motion is merely motion, and randomity is motion with an expectancy. Minus randomity is you expected a little motion and you got less than that. Plus randomity is you expected a lot of motion, you got more than that. Optimum randomity with getting the amount of motion you expected, or not much more. Now, the facts of tolerance are best recognized while running the process by the individual's quieting down as he runs it, you know. He gets grim after a while, he gets apathetic, he gets this way and he gets that way. But the point of it is he gets less rambunctious as he runs it, and he finally runs it well. And then he runs it because he thinks it's fun. And then the process is flat. He's running it because he thinks it's fun. Now, many phenomena occur while you're running this opening procedure by duplication, which we could simply call processing by duplication, or simply duplication today, because we don't have any rivals for it. We'll find him going up the mystery to know scale. And that scale, of course, starting from the top down, goes know, look, emotion, effort, think, symbols, eat, sex, mystery. Now, there is your important scale for this, because your preclear runs this scale as he's doing duplication, and he doesn't know what he's running, but you do. You've got one on him, and he was usually starting at mystery. He doesn't know why the devil he's doing this, and he goes on up through sex and eating and symbols and thinking and effort and emotion. And looking and knowing. Now, how do you know if he's running this scale? Well, he comments on it. He comments on it in those orders. The odd part of it is down in the bottom of the mystery scale, you have harmonics of the whole scale, so he does skips at first. He goes from it's all a mystery to him to it's hard work to look at it, you know. And he wishes this book was a sexy one, and he is getting pretty mad, and then he knows why you're doing it. He doesn't know the right reason at all, but he says he does. And then as he comes up scale, he's running over these lower harmonics. And he eventually, by the way, if you were keeping up a two-way comm and listening to his comments, you would find out he'd go up a clean, clear, mystery to know scale. He would simply hit each one right on the way up. Now, he doesn't even know these, but he doesn't know them, but he will comment on them, which is a curiosity to the auditor. He'll know how far this fellow's gone. Well, now, so much for the phenomena involved. How do you do the process itself? Opening procedure by duplication is done in a quiet room, preferably not too small a room, since we don't want the preclear to get a square head or you to get a square head. Did you ever sit in a square room a long time and feel odd? I call your attention to notice sometime that you get a square head. You get points on your head. And so therefore the room shouldn't be too small. But There ought to be enough room to walk around in a little bit. Now, we take two objects, preferably a book and a bottle, simply because an awful lot of auditing have been done with these two with no consequences, and there are some other objects which, when chosen, have become unfortunate. And these seem to even pick up the alcoholics and the bookworms and never troubles anybody. So any kind of a book and any kind of a bottle. And we put one of them on a table. Preferably, we put it about waist height, see, so the individual isn't doing... the object of the process is not to do bends, you know. I mean, not to do Swedish calisthenics. The exercise is just to walk to these two objects. And we put these two tables fairly widely apart, maybe, 6, 8, 10 feet, anything like that. And the auditor sits a bit back. He sits rather well away from the preclear. We want to do a minimum amount of this snap terminal business on the preclear anyhow, because when you start him in, he's usually allergic to bodies. He doesn't like anybody up on top of him. And we have this preclear then in session. We assume already that we have audited him several times. We assume that we have begun this particular session, taken up any present time problem. We assume that he is in fairly good condition. He's not physically ill temporarily. It'd be a bad time to run this. We assume you're going to run it within the meaning and rules of the auditor's code. And we give him some acquaintance of what we're doing. We say, well, now, that's a book over there, and that's a bottle, and you're going to have a lot to do with these two things here for a little while, because we have a little process here which is aimed at improving your perception. Well, you'll always buy that. Thetans always want to look at something. So you say it improves your perception, and a little bit onerous. I have had preclears run away and quit and stop and so forth, mostly because they couldn't take it. It's a little bit tough, but I haven't had any die outright yet. You want to reassure him. And he'll sort of toughen his view up on this a little bit. And it's a little bit necessary that you do this anyway with a preclear. When you're starting sessions with preclears, it's not enough to say, now I'm the auditor, you're the preclear, and now you understand a session is in progress and we're going to begin auditing and here we go. That's for the birds. You do all these things. If they are not present, if there is any misunderstanding about any one of these points, or you suspect there is, you take it up with two-way communication and you clarify it. You get the idea? But if all of those things are there and they are present and you observably have a session in progress and the preclear observably has an auditing room, you just sail from there, you see? You don't have to take all this up by rote, but you better take it up by perception. If your preclear is not in session and he's not in the auditing room, we'd better get him there. So we assume that these basic steps have been taken. Your preclear is pretty well upscale. And we show him the book, show him the bond. We explain to him we'll probably kill him in some fashion or another. So we'll beef up his expectancy a little bit. We'll put a little force into it, see? So he won't be too calm about this. What he's been doing up to this time, decisional processing and so forth, he found to be fun and it's very useful. And this is apparently the world's most destructive process. And he's going to do this with his body. And he's going to feel at times while he's running this, and occasionally some preclears feel like he's going to come into pieces. So we're going to get him so that he understands something a little more might occur than it's been occurring in the past. And it might not be quite so much fun, but it will increase his perception, probably. Be doubtful about that. Leave him room to cognite on that, you see. And we start him in. And the pattern of it is very simple. Actually, we tell him to walk over to the book and pick it up and tell us about it, and then walk over to the bottle and pick it up and tell us about it, and walk over to the book and pick it up and tell us about it, and walk over to the bottle and pick it up and tell us about it. That's really the mechanics of the process. But, it is only a useful process if the exact auditing commands are used every time without any variation whatsoever, and this probably to an auditor who hasn't had it flattened on him is the most brutal and wicked part of the process. You must use these auditing commands the same way every time. They must not be varied in order. Therefore, they must be learned. And preferably, if you were doing it for the first time, you had better write some notes of order down on a little piece of paper. You know? The order of command. Just a little scribbled note of some sort to keep you on the groove, because this must not be varied. Now, these commands are set when you use them and as you use them. There is no magical incantation here, so there could be some variation in the command when it's first written down. But we could decide on these are the commands. But after we have decided, then we use them, and we never vary them, and we never break pace in the middle of session. We don't change them around afterwards. We're going to vary any commands. We're going to vary them before the session begins. You get that idea? In the first place, you're not going to really vary any commands, because this has been run a very, very great deal. And what we don't know about these commands today isn't really worth looking into. And we know what makes the process work and why it works. Now, the original opening procedure by duplication was a very, very curious thing. It was an entirely different process than this one, but it did the same order of commands and almost the same commands. This is really first postulate duplication we're doing at level 4 of SLP, issue 5. It's really first postulate duplication. Why first postulate? Well, I told you the other day about the, you know, about the native state, first postulate, second postulate. It's the I don't know postulate duplication. So this is really not in its purest state opening procedure by duplication. It's first postulate duplication. Now, we have run this a great deal in the past with another set of commands. These commands were almost the same, but they didn't contain the don't know factor. They contain the know factor. Well, know is a second postulate, which made the process run much longer. And when you hear of this horrible thing called old-time duplication, you are talking about a second postulate process, one which picked up an artificiality of knowingness and beat it to death. And actually, it was impeding the process. It was nothing for this process to be run for 20, 30 hours. It was called Dirty 30. Actually, Dirty 30 had two more commands to it, but they got lost in the shuffle. One of them was, what part of your past wouldn't you mind owning? Which is curious, because it was simply an intuitive command that I dreamed up. It finally turned out to be ownership processing. Now, the old time opening procedure by duplication went this way. We would say to the individual, "Do you see that book?" And we'd ask him to, he'd say yes. We'd say, "All right, walk over to it." And he'd say, "Okay," walk over to it. He'd say, "Fine." You know, we acknowledge the fact he did. And we'd tell him, "Pick it up." And he would. And then we'd say, "Tell me something about its color." And when he would, we'd say, "Tell me something about its temperature." And when he did, we would say, "Tell me something about its weight," and he would. And then we'd tell him to put it down exactly in the same place. And then, of course, we would say, "Do you see that bottle?" And he would say, "Yes." We'd tell him to walk over to it. We'd go through the same sequence of commands. All right. That was the old one. Now, the new one is a first postulate thing. And this particular level 4 of issue 5 here is built on the supposition that a curious thing has happened already, that you have flattened Waterloo Station on your brake line. You flatten it. Now, flattening Waterloo Station would actually consist of the individual being able to not know at will. See? And these commands given here on the sheet assume that the individual is no longer troubled by your telling him to simply not know something. So, the commands given here are, do you see that book? And he says, yes. And you say, all right, walk over to it. And he does. And we say, fine. And we say, pick it up. And he does. And we say, not know something about its color. Now, you see why we'd have to have a little dress rehearsal here with our pre-clear. We'd have to get that real clear with him. Not know something about its color. But if he's already flat in Waterloo Station, he will catch on to this at once. Now, he does not know something, and he tells you what he has not known about its color, which is an oddity because he's not known it, so he really wouldn't be able to tell you. But he does. And we then say, all right, not know something about its temperature. And he does and tells you, and you say, that's fine. And then, and by the way, he'll get up to a point here very shortly where he will simply say, I have. Then you ought to be smart enough at that point not to say, what is it? Listen, he just not knew it. Get the idea? And he has not known something about its temperature, and now he's not known something about its weight. We told him to, and he did. And we asked him to put it down exactly in the same place, and he did. We said, fine. And then we say, do you see that bottle? And he says, yes. And we tell him, all right, walk over to it. And he says, he does, and says, okay. And we say, fine, and we say, pick it up. And he does, and we say, not know something about its color. And he does, and tells us, says something about it. We say, fine, and then we say, not know something about its temperature. And he fumbles around with it and feels it, and he does. And then we say, not know something about its weight. And he does, and that's fine. We say, put it down exactly in the same place. And then we say, now, do you see that book? And he says, yes. And we say, all right, walk over to it. And here we go. You see, we tell him exactly these same commands. We tell him, pick it up. And he does. And we say, all right, now, not know something about its color. And he does and signifies he has, and we say that's fine. We say not know something about its temperature. We just keep this going back and forth with those exact commands, back and forth, back and forth. Very curious what'll happen to this fellow's perception. He'll exteriorize, yo-yo, he'll do all sorts of odd things. But the main thing he'll do will be to take over the automaticity of his not knowing this experience machines and so forth. He'll do all sorts of interesting things. But you keep right at the process. Now, should you sit there like a dummy, just giving out these commands as though you were in a piece of tape or something, you know? Should you? Hmm? No, you definitely should not. The fellow says, whoa, what do you know? I just went, I don't know, I just went kind of dizzy. And we say, oh, you did? What's the matter? Just got dizzy all of a sudden, and it's all. And you say, well, is it all right now? It's not so bad now. You say, well, that's fine. Now, not know something about its temperature. Get the idea? You consult that two-way communication in there. You don't let him sit down. You don't let him break up the actual actions. You don't let him go wandering off and flop off and relax and so forth, but you do catch his originated communications, and you do talk with the fellow between commands. An omission to do this is brutal on the pre-clear. It is murder when you omit this. It may do him more harm than good. So you have to handle this with two-way communication. You don't make a bunch of idle chatter. You don't let him go sit down. You don't let him have a smoke suddenly. If you start him on this process, you make awful sure you've got 3-5 hours ahead of you, if you have to have. And you run it flat. You don't run it flat by running it in 8 separate sessions of 20 minutes each. Got that? It's a slugfest. It's a grind. You've got to have time ahead of you. It's not something that you're going to do in 10 minutes. You may flatten it in 1.5 hours, and you may not flatten it in 3 hours. It may take you 5 before this thing starts coming clean with this individual. Now, there are other auditing commands that can be used in the place of this. I've just told you about second postulate one. Evidently, about 1 hour of first postulate duplication is worth about 25 to 50 hours of second postulate duplication. So I guess there's not much choice between whether we run old second postulate or new first postulate. We'll run new first postulate because we don't want to grind at it that long. But within this frame of reference, there is this factor which you must know about not knowingness. The preclear can always run this command about not knowingness. Tell me something you wouldn't mind not knowing about it. You can always run this command, see? Tell me something you wouldn't mind not knowing about its color. Tell me something you wouldn't mind not knowing about its temperature. Tell me something you wouldn't mind not knowing about its weight. You see? He can always run that because he doesn't feel that he factually exactly has to unknow the thing. Crunch. See? So that is a more permissive process. You see it? And although it's a little more wordy, if there's any question about the wording, you fall back onto it. Right above that level, he will be able to not know. He could run this command. Not know something about its temperature. Not know something about its weight. You see, he could run that command. And above that, he would be able to run this command evidently easily. Tell me something you don't know about its color, its temperature, and its weight. Tell me something you don't know, see? But there is a spectrum of processes. There are other little points on the spectrum, but the first one and the lowest one is the most permissive one. Tell me something you wouldn't mind not knowing about its color. See, that's the most permissive, that's the easiest to run, the one least susceptible to argument. Above that is this not know process. There's another intermediate process that isn't quite as exact as tell me something you could not know about its color, but it's a little more difficult to get across. And it's really not a tougher process. The one that's tougher is, say, not know something about its weight. And the one that's real rough, because it throws re-stimulation into the bank, confusion injects, a lot of other things happen, is this top one, which is tell me something you don't know about it. Or don't know something about it. Individual could handle this either way, but he'd have to be very tolerant to confusion before he could do that. That was the first way this was run and tested, by the way. It was run with the command, tell me something you don't know about its color. Tell me something you don't know about its temperature. Tell me something you don't know about its weight. That was the way it was run, and it was quite successful, and people got away with it. It was very successful even run with that command. But it probably would run far, far better on a preclear, who had flattened Waterloo Station, just as it's written there. Not know something about its color. But if a preclear was still floundering on Waterloo Station, and for some reason or other it wasn't flat, you wanted to run this process anyway, you could, you know. Yeah, go pick up a Black 5 and run it on him. So what? See? Nearly every one of these processes, except level 6, can be run at once on the preclear. And level 6 could only be run if you banged him 3 feet back of his head and ran it from there, you know. If you could exteriorize, you could run level 6 right off the bat. Any one of these processes contained in your SLP, issue 5, can be run independently as long as we run it in the rationale of level 1. See? They all run independently. That is, we're not working with a graduated scale here. It's not important anymore. We aren't working on a ladder. We have found basic processes which practically shoot the moon in every case. Individuals will tell you, you can go all the way with this process. Invent a game is a process which you can go all the way with. Your preclear will tell you after a while. Assign an intention is a game that you can go all the way with, you know. Probably if somebody really flattened completely that little point that is now in level 1, opening procedure of 8C, you know, touch the wall and so forth. I probably go all the way on this, except nobody's ever had enough patience to flatten it completely. Don't know of anybody ever really flattening it all the way. Auditors fail to perceive the little flaws which are going on in the execution of the command. They say, oh, that's flat. The individual's acting better than Homo sapiens ordinarily would act, so therefore it's flat. It's not true. He probably eventually exteriorized, and then you'd run it on him exteriorized. You'd have him do 8C exteriorized. That's, by the way, its first use was on an exteriorized preclear. You had the Thetan do all the steps which you're having the preclear's body do. All right. Now, what if the individual exteriorized on this? What if he blew out of his head? You just keep it up with the body. You'd acknowledge the fact that he'd blown out of his head. You'd listen to what he had to say, but you'd just keep on running. Get the idea? You wouldn't do anything sudden. You wouldn't do anything sudden. You wouldn't say, oh, you've exteriorized. Well, that's that, and have him sit down and have a cigarette. That'd be a real bad one. It'd leave him stuck right there. Now, simply the fact of exteriorizing will stick a guy on the track. You know that? Guy afterwards is liable to keep exteriorizing with the facsimile he first exteriorized with. You got the idea? So therefore, we don't pay much attention to when any fellow goes out of his head these days, except to discuss it with him, to acknowledge it, to say, hurrah, hurrah, three cheers. See? We say, that's fine, good, swell, fine, how is it? And we, as is the fact and experience with the two-way communication, we acknowledge it, we tell him we know what's happened to him, we can appreciate it, we understand this, we go ahead, and then we go on, keep on running the process we were running. This is a new look at this situation slightly. This was in question before, but it's not in question any longer. We know now the best thing to do is just to acknowledge the fact he exteriorized, talk to him about it, have him tell you anything he wants to, but continue running the process that you were running. Just go on with the process. So he exteriorizes on this. Now, the funny part of it is he's most likely of all processes to exteriorize on this one. May sound curious to you. We have remedy of havingness exteriorization, where we have him mock up havingness and shove it into the body. You get the difference between that and pull it into the body. We say, all right, can you mock up something? You mock up planet? And he says, yup. You say, well, mock one up. All right, now shove it into the body. Push it into the body. And he does, and you mock up another one and push that into the body. We don't say pull it into the body. If we pull it into the body, he's inside pulling it in. Well, we don't do that. What we do is have him shove it into the body from outside, and he'll wake up to the fact after a while. I don't care if he's a black 99. If you can do this at all, you can have him mock up black masses or confusions or something and have him shove these into the body. He's liable to wake up after a while that in order to shove them into the body, he has to be outside of the body shoving them in. Get the idea? And he wakes up and says, I'm exteriorized. Now, I don't know with what certainty, but I'm sure out here somewhere. All right, so that's an exteriorization process that takes place under remedy of havingness. Exteriorization might be expected very brightly under decisional processing. The only reason that was wrong with second postulate Union Station in the earliest days, you know, was the fact that nobody was exteriorizing on it, and they are exteriorizing on Waterloo Station. They do blow out of their heads doing it. So they might exteriorize almost any place. You might start a session with them and they exteriorize. They might exteriorize any place on the sixth level. But of these various places, I think they're most likely to exteriorize on the average. If they haven't previously, they're most likely to exteriorize on this. Opening procedure by duplication, if only to get away from the torture of it. Now, when they make sudden grimaces, when they twitch and start coughing, that is not up to you to sit there like a carven sphinx. An auditor who talks too much should be shot. An auditor who talks too much should be shot. He's always interjecting a bunch of comments and values and so forth. But by that we mean an auditor who originates way above the preclear's origin should be shot. See, he's always injecting himself on the scene somehow or another. We're not supposed to efface him, but he's just throwing this two-way communication so far out of balance. He's always got to talk to the preclear. See, he's always got to say something. Well, the out-of-balance part of the two-way communication is that the preclear doesn't originate enough. He never does. Same way around, an auditor who doesn't talk enough ought to be shot. How much do you talk? Enough. But we've somehow got to make the preclear originate more communications because he doesn't originate enough communications. See, we've got to make him originate more because we're originating all the time. By just the process of auditing, we're originating all the time. We've got to make him originate more. How do we do that? Ah, this is a nice little trick. We watch for the flick of the eyelash that says he had a thought or a sensation. He had a somatic. He had a change somehow or another. And we right away, quick, we acknowledge it. We don't say, what is wrong? That's old and passé. What we say is, okay, what happened? We say, okay, and then we originate the backflow, see? In other words, we let him complete an originated communication to our okay. Do you have it? We say, very well. You know, the individual goes, we say, very well, what happened? And you know, it kind of sticks in his mind that he said something to him. Actually, an emotion, a twitch, an upset of some kind or another, actually is a solidified communication. He would have said it if he still could talk on that subject, you see. And so we acknowledge it. We say, very well, fine, right, okay, anything we care to say, and then we say, what happened? See, it's wrong. He has a twitch, and we say, what happened? See, that's wrong. He has a twitch, we say, very well, what happened? Now, some of us who are indoctrinated into the other school sometimes skid on that for a while. See, we skid on it a little bit, but we catch the hang of it in a hurry. We don't say, when he all of a sudden convulses in the middle of the floor, what's happening? See? We say, very well, fine, fine. What happened? Fine hell, you'll say, I'm dying. And you say, yes, 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 I know. What can we do about it? He said he was dying with a convulsion and then said he was dying verbally. Get the idea? He said it twice, only the first was nonverbal. The twitch, the convulsion, these are alike efforts to communicate. We acknowledge them as such, and that's how we keep in a two-way communication with the auditor. And you're going to see more of this kind of thing in duplication than in any other of those processes. He's going to twitch and convulse and fidget and sigh. And each one of these things, he originated a communication. Now, we could overdo this. We'd overdo it why the auditor is informed by the pre-clears calling his attention to it. And the way the pre-clear calls the auditor's attention to this is very simple. He says, you know, I don't feel like I can keep a single secret from you. See? He feels he's telling his all. He's giving it all up. He's talking too much. You know, he's a little bit uneasy about it, so we just cut off on it a little bit. Get the idea? They make a very similar remark about this. If you were to go out here on the street, and every time somebody coughed or something like that, we said very well, they would look at us and know that they'd been in communication with us. They would really, most of the time, not be aware of the fact that they had not said something. See? They would think they had said something. Because it is a communication. We'll see a lot of that in duplication. Two-way communication is very important in duplication, and it's a very important piece of adjudication because the auditor must stay in two-way communication with the preclear without interrupting the duplicative commands. See that? He can put stuff in the middle, like meat and a sandwich, but by golly, the bread's what's important. You see? And he's got to give those commands regularly, over and over and over. Now, he doesn't have to stretch it. Don't run them too slow. Don't run them too fast. Speed has nothing to do with it. Just give them as fast as the pre-clear executes them. This process, I don't know what it will do in your hands, but this process runs flat ordinarily in 1.5 to 5 hours. And so you want enough time to do that. Now, the great oddity of the process is that it does produce exteriorization, and we don't do anything about it. We simply acknowledge the fact that it has occurred. We run the process with regularity. We run it with patience. The preclear looks like he's going to blow the session. We two-way calm him out of it right there and go right on with the session. We got that? And we audit him very, very smoothly. A good auditor and good ARC are necessary to get the best and most out of this process. Bad ARC can wreck it as it can any process. And I wish you a lot of success with this particular process. Thank you.